We don't have a quorum just yet, but we're going to get started, and we'll do all the necessary paperwork and motions when we get a quorum. So if I could call down, we're going to hear House File 3140 first. I'm not going to try and say, pronounce all that. I'm not. So if Representative Kodesh-Podein, the one that wants to go be a senator. Why do you want a demotion?
You know, I just want to take all those good things that you've taught me these last 4 years and move them on over to the Senate.
It hasn't helped with all the rest of them that we've sent there.
We'll see what we can do. All right. So good morning. I am presenting to you this morning House File 3140. It is an appropriation request out of the general fund for a grant to the Indigenous People Task Force for creating the McWaneden Atasukun Center in Minneapolis. It makes the appropriation contingent on equal funding being committed from non-state sources, and they have secured those funds, so we just need this last bit in order to make it happen. And I'll just talk a little bit about the Indigenous People Task Force. It is, I would say, an anchor of the community in South Minneapolis and has provided many services to the American Indian community. Most importantly, it was one of the first HIV prevention sites for that community, and it wasn't just for the American Indian folks, but it was for others as well. It uses cultural arts to support the youth in the community. There are plays and all kinds of activities that go on with our Indigenous youth. They look to promote Indigenous healing traditions, and we have the director, the founder of it, Sharon Day here. She conducts Nibby walks all around the country, and those are water walks to honor and remind us of the value of the waters in our country. And for so many reasons, this is so important that we fund this expansion. And for that, I'm going to turn it over to former Representative Susan Allen, excuse me. And then we will ask Sharon, Sharon Day to give us the last bit of information.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee and welcome back. You know, I'm ending here in a year. I'm not coming back. I'm not showing up again for a long time, as long as I can make it. Why don't you fill us in on this particular project? And
thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Susan Allen. I'm a member of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. I'm also Ojibwe and Dakota. And I'm here as in the capacity as a longtime board member of the Indigenous People's Task Force, and also my grandkids have participated in the programs, and I've known Sharon for over 25 years, and who is a mentor. And when she asked me to come here, I said no to two other requests, and when Sharon asked me, I would always say yes, so I'm here. And this, as you can see in the beginning here, McWaneden Atasukun means remember our teachings. The task force exists to serve the urban Indian community, to promote the general welfare and the health of community members. It started out as a voluntary response, a task force to assist Native Americans that had AIDS and then American Indians who are living with HIV to provide housing and services, and they continue to provide preventative services. And all of that is done through traditional teachings and curriculum and programming and with elders and with, and this is a capital campaign that has broad support. It was initially heavily funded by the Shakopee, Minnewaukan, and Sioux community through development, to do the design, capital campaign funding. And it is something that have a lot of individual donors, and their primary reason for donating is to honor the work that the task force does, and also to honor, to recognize that we are on Indian lands, former Indian lands, and for them that is a way of participating and recognizing that. And we have other tribes that are assisting, and then foundations. And so we are coming to the legislature, and Representative Kunish Podine reminds us, not only does she advocate well for her constituents, but she reminds us that Indian people in this state are citizens of this state. Indian people in the urban community have been there since the 1950s, during the 1957 Removal Act, or Relocation Act. I'm sorry, there's been so many different acts. The Relocation Act, and the BIA gave Indian people assistance to relocate to Minneapolis, and provided them help for about 6 months, and that was it. And so there's a lot of Indian from generation to generation have been here. My own family was relocated for a period of time, both my paternal and maternal grandparents, to California. And so many of us grew up in urban areas. And so this is a capital campaign that if you were to come visit the task center, you would see people living in the community, those who are still suffering from addiction, who are living with HIV, and you would see youth who are have sometimes been in the program since they were 14, are now 24 years old, and that how it has transformed their lives through the program, through the arts, the theater, the garden programs, the traditional teachings. They go to schools and perform. Sharon Day is the first American Indian playwright to appear at the Guthrie. Mm-hmm. And so it is a place of healing, and a place where youth are completely transformed. It's just remarkable the amount of confidence that they have, and self-esteem, and have very comfortable with remembering their teachings and performing and talking to other youth. So it is something that is very much an integral part of the urban Indian community along the Franklin corridor.
Thank you.
And next we have Sharon Day.
Yeah, bonjour. Good morning. I just want to say that we're so close to being able to begin construction this summer, this fall. We do have broad support, both foundations and Shakopee has provided a great deal of support. We also have a number of individual donors who've contributed, and this is the first time that we've ever had this level of individual donors, which makes me very happy. We own property, we own a housing complex that we built in 1997, 14 units of accessible housing. They're beautiful buildings, the organic living space, and right now, like, all of our staff are housed in the community center for the housing. It was developed as a place for the community members who lived in our housing to come and have ceremonies, birthday parties, to get out of their house and come. And we've moved into that community center in 2008 when there was a recession, and we've been there ever since. And so it's wonderful space for a community, people to gather, but it's not a wonderful place to have counseling and testing for community members. It doesn't have that clinical space, and so we've had to convert space in there. The laundry room became an office. The two accessible bathrooms on the first floor became offices for case management. and everybody else is, I myself am now sharing my office with three other staff people. And the land that we're going to build on is adjacent to our current housing complex. It's between us and Waite House. There's a vacant lot. And the city of Minneapolis has agreed to contribute that land to us, valued about $188,000 for a dollar. And so we have support from the city, and we just really need this space. The building will be somewhat sustainable in that we will use, it'll have passive solar in the front, and we'll capture all of the water that comes down, and some of the walls in the front will be made out of compressed earth block. We've trained young people in the neighborhood how to make this earth block. And we'll continue to train more as we move forward. But we're ready to go. We just have, you know, this little, the building itself is $5 million for construction. And we've raised $3 million of that right now. So we're ready to go. And, you know, $5 million is not a lot of money when you look at construction. And as we see buildings going up all around us, you know, and we're still struggling, we decided to come to you. We met with Representative Kunesh Podein and said, can you give us a hand? And so here we are, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee members? Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps to Ms. Day, I had a great tour of the Native American Community Clinic regarding their bonding request a couple of months ago. And they certainly drove home to me the cultural base from which they work and utilizing their treatment and services for the community. And I see that you're also offering health services, and they've got street workers who focus, as I understand it, not only on getting people off the streets where possible, but HIV and Hep C and things like that. So I'm wondering about coordination. You know, how are community groups working together?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll just tell you, we're also doing. So we do HIV counseling and testing. And our funding from that comes from the Center for Disease Control. We're the only Native organization in the country to a community-based organization to receive direct funding, and we have for 20 years. So we began as an HIV organization and have continued that work and expanded now into, you know, all of those attendant problems. Syringe exchange and Narcan training. We train people in how to use Narcan, and we have a small grant now from just received from DHS for navigation, helping people to get into housing as well. And so if you know the Phillips neighborhood, you'll know that the problem is huge. We distributed over 100,000 needles last year. You know, we have the highest rate of death from overdose. So it's not as though only one organization needs to exist. Mm-hmm. We provide services that that complement NAC, but our clinical services are simply counseling and testing, both for HIV and Hep C.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you also have any kind of treatment facilities there? I know, you know, I'm on the opioid task force, and so we're going to be, you know, doing a lot of work on helping folks get treatment in recovery programs. Do you guys have any of those there as well?
No, but across our parking lot is the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center, and they do provide treatment services for women. Ours is more prevention, and so we're working with younger people to prevent not only and drug use, but also tobacco, and we have a tobacco prevention program that's funded by DHS as well. And so the youth that come into our program, our goal is to keep them healthy. You know, it's sort of when I talk about the water, you know, when you mess it up, it's harder to clean it up later, right? So a lot of our work has to do with prevention, keeping young people healthy, you know, and they have to deal with all of the effects of when somebody in their family is using. And so we help them with that. And through some of our traditional teachings, they understand that what they need to do to stay healthy. So we do not provide treatment, but we work very hard to get those people who are using into some of the medical assistant treatment programs as well as other programs.
Great, and I think one of the things that, you know, the task force is also looking at is supporting some of those prevention programs as well. So I'd love to touch base with you.
Yes, I can't stress enough that yesterday, Tuesday, I went to the over to the staff who were working. We rent space in the church down the street right now for our after-school program, and I went over there, and we had, you know, about 15 youth there, and they were all working on some lessons and working on an animation, and also they worked on three pieces of a play that will focus on suicide prevention. That's another one of our programs, and so the youth come in either through the Ketowin Youth Theater Program, the Wabenegay Tobacco Prevention Program, or Keep the Fire Alive, which is suicide prevention program. But when I sat there with them in that circle, and they all went around and said said their name, said Bujou, and they said their name in their language, you know, 20 years ago that never would have happened. But there is a resurgence in our community in cultural teachings and our identity. And that is probably what's going to do more to offset some of the other issues we have. So when I wrote this handout that you have, I tried to focus on what we're doing in positive ways, because there's so much, we know that we have so many problems, but we really try to look at how can we move forward in a way that's based on our seven sacred teachings.
Representative Koznick, and we're going to move this along pretty quickly here because we've got wage theft and some questions about that. So, Representative Koznick.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I wasn't going to say anything, but I just wanted to I'll keep my comments short, but thank you for presenting your project here, and I'm looking at the bill and listening to the testimony, and I'm not hearing a lot about economic development and jobs. Reading the bill, you are in the right committee according to the way the bill is written, but I think listening to the testimony, you should be in capital investments or health and human services, and I'll just leave it at that.
We are going to be moving it to capital investments.
Representative
Moran.
Respond briefly to that.
We're going to move you along here, and you're going to – Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good to see you, Susan Allen. It's also looking through the brochure. Can you talk a little bit about why the urban sanctuary in healing and learning is something that you need to be doing with the Native American community? The sanctuary.
Explain why the sanctuary is so important to healing for indigenous communities.
We don't have any spaces like that right now, and we need that to be able to do the kinds of healing and teaching that we need to do. I don't know what else to say about that.
The space was created through a community meetings. It's a vision of we wanted it to be sustainable, and so the part on the bottom will be earth block construction, and that is what makes it eligible for the new market tax credits. We have youth learning earth block construction, and then it is a space where with commercial kitchen to cook indigenous foods and a black box theater. And so it is about creating spaces which is lacking in the urban Indian community.
Seeing no other questions, I will renew my motion to pass and refer House File 3140 to the Capital Investment.
Thank you.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign.
Aye.
You're on your way to Capital Investment. Good luck.
Thank you.
Let's see. President Stevenson, I'm sure you've taken a look at the minutes.
I have, Chair, reviewed them word for word, and I would move them.
All those in, are there any? I have a correction. Somehow or another, Representative Hassan was left off, so I would move that she is added to the list of members present.
Well, you didn't.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any other corrections to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of the minutes as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. We are going to hear, I don't want that one. We're going to take the rest of the committee today to talk about and listen to comments about the bill that we passed last year, which is wage theft. We've had a couple of attempts at conversations that didn't get all the way there. So we're going to do that today. I'm not sure how this is going to play out, whether it's going to be contentious or anything like that. But I know there could be a lot of questions, and there's a good number of testifiers. So what I am going to set the ground rule is that if people have questions, and we'll go through the commissioner and then some of the testifiers, excuse me, and then have questions at the end, but rather than have unlimited questions, we're going to do two questions each. So if I'll ask a couple of questions and then go on to the next person. And if you have questions, a third question, we'll come back to you so that everybody gets an opportunity to ask their questions. So with that, excuse me, Commissioner Lepik, would you please come down and start talking about what you've done since we've passed wage theft last year. I was going to compliment myself, but I'll skip that.
Thank you, Chair Mahoney, members of the committee. I'm Nancy Lepink, and I'm the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. It's a pleasure to be here this morning and to update the committee on the department's work over the last 9 months since the wage theft prevention bill was passed into the law by the legislature and signed by the governor. Just a little bit of housekeeping, Chair. And Mahoney, I have a hard stop at 9:20, I'm sorry, but I have my assistant commissioner, Nicole Blissenbach, here, who is also fully prepared to answer any questions that the committee may have. She has been working as my right hand on all of the matters related to wage theft since the law was passed last year, and she's fully equipped to answer the committee's questions. First of all, I think it's important to recall that the wage theft prevention law put in place several significant provisions, a provision that made wage theft a crime similar to other types of theft, provisions that enhanced the enforcement authority of the department to combat violations of the state's labor standards laws, which will help employees and employers who play by the rules. Provisions that protect workers from retaliation when they complain either to the department or to the employer about concerns they have related to their employment situation. provisions that require additional information to be provided on earning statements so that there is more transparency for employers about the employees about the wages they have earned and the amount of money that they are ultimately paid, and provisions that require written notice be provided to employees at the beginning of the employment relationship that sets out key terms and conditions of that relationship, such as what is their rate of pay or rates of pay, and what kind of deductions may be taken from that pay by their employer. These written notices, and then also an obligation of the employer to inform the worker that if they're going to change those key terms of employment, that the employee needs to have notice of that change before the change is made. So the purpose of this, of course, is to, so employees and employers begin and remain on the same page about the terms and conditions of their employment relationship. And so therefore, from the very beginning, there's complete transparency, and ideally with that complete transparency, there's actually prevention of disputes or misunderstandings that may occur later in that employment relationship. Since the Wage Theft Prevention Act was signed into law on May 30th, the department's focus has been on developing guidance and related resources to assist employers and employees in understanding the new law's protections and requirements, and engaging in outreach, presentations, and events involving both employers and employees across the state. The department has utilized a multifaceted approach to inform and educate employees and employers about the new law. Since June, the department has used GovDelivery, which is a mechanism by which the government can communicate electronically with its constituents, to push out information about the new law on multiple occasions. And because of the shortness of time, I will not list them all, but let it be said that we have put out over 100,000 direct communications to those persons who have signed up for that kind of government delivery with the department. And in particular, we pushed out directly to employers, to over 50,000 employers, information about the new wage theft law. In addition to providing recipients with information about the new law and directing them to resources on the department's website, all of these communications have also encouraged recipients to contact the department to seek assistance, to seek presentations for their organizations or for other employers in their communities. And we have not turned down a single request for a meeting or presentation since the bill was enacted 9 months ago. The department has also had a significant increase in phone calls and emails by approximately 15%, and the majority of those calls and emails are related to seeking assistance with how to come into compliance with the new law's requirements. And also, of course, often when you pass a new law, employers and workers look at their situation, and therefore many of the calls have also spurred people to come to the department to clarify other employment law and labor standards issues that they may have. So just to be brief, the department has also had direct in-person either meetings or presentations, but primarily presentations, over 80 of them since the law was passed, and we have 40 more already scheduled for the coming months. So over the last 9 months, the department has engaged in 11 presentations with educational organizations and associations. And that includes the Minnesota School Board Association, of which there were formal meetings, presentations, and follow-up phone calls, the Charter School Conference, the Minnesota Association of School Personnel Administrators, just to name a few. We've done 13 presentations with employer and employee organizations and associations in the construction sector. We've met with the Union Construction Industry Contractors, the Associated General Contractors, the Northwestern Minnesota Construction Alliance, the Iron Range Construction Alliance and Chisholm, Twin Ports Construction Alliance, the Associated Builders and Contractors of Minnesota and North Dakota, to name also just a few. We've done 30 presentations to various chambers of commerce, regional employer groups, human resource groups, and the Minnesota Business Taxpayer Partnership. And that's included right out of the gate on this June 20th, a statewide webinar with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, but then following with the Iron Range Chambers at the IRRRB, the Burnsville Chamber, the Wyndham Chamber, the New Ulm Chamber, the Midgie Chamber, the Worthington Chamber, the Fargo-Moorhead Chamber, Mankato Small Business Development Center, the Monticello Area Human Resources Group, Elk River Chamber of Commerce, Prior Lake Chamber, and so on. So the department has not just been sitting in St. Paul. We have gone to all corners of the state, meeting with people who've requested us to come and assist them and also to proactively contact these organizations to find opportunities for us to speak. We've given 6 presentations to government associations and organizations. We have 17 presentations to nonprofit, community, and labor-focused and worker-focused organizations, 14 presentations for industry-specific associations and organizations, including the Minnesota Grocers Association, Hospitality Minnesota, American Payroll Association, Minnesota Recruiting and Staffing Association, Paychecks Direct Employers Clients, Twin Cities Compensation Network, Hospitality Minnesota's Annual Expo, Littler Midwest Employer Conference, Midwest Golf Course Owners Association, Minnesota Child, and we have planned the Minnesota Child Care Association and the Minnesota Home Care Association in the coming months. So the department recognizes that despite our best efforts, there are still employers in Minnesota who may be unaware of their responsibilities under the new law and employees who are unaware of their rights. And the department takes its outreach and education seriously, believing it to be an important strategy in preventing violations of the law, and welcomes suggestions from the committee on how best to reach those remaining employers that and employees that we have not yet had the opportunity to engage. So most of the employers who have contacted the department with questions about the new law have expressed their appreciation for the assistance provided by the department and have communicated that many, if not all, of their concerns were resolved after talking with department staff. Employers have expressed that while initially concerned about the new law's employee notice requirements, which is really the only requirement that requires employers to take specific action, that after providing the notice to their employees, they recognize the value of the engagement, that engagement with their workforce. One employer at an outreach event shared with the department staff that she was initially very upset when she learned about the employee notice requirements and the extra work it would mean for her. But after providing notices to her employees, she stated she really appreciated the engagement with her workforce that happened because of the notice requirements. Another small auto shop employer who called the department with a question about a final paycheck issue that led to questions about the new employee notice requirement expressed at the end of the conversation that the notice requirement was a good idea and a practical one despite the time it would take to implement, since it sets out the terms of employment, the employment relationship, and gets everyone on the same page from the get-go. Another large business expressed to the department staff that the notice requirement was a good idea because while they had all the information required in the notice and then some, they didn't have it all in the all the information in one place. And the notice requirement essentially serves as a cheat sheet for the this business to quickly access high-level information and a quick reference if there's a need to further dig into the particular situation. The department has provided employers and employees through the development of a variety of materials the following: a summary of the new guide's provisions, guidance for employers, guidance for employees in English and in 13 other languages, ongoing and continually updated Q&A addressing the most commonly asked questions and department's responses to those questions, 3 informational videos on employee notice requirements, earning statements, and record keeping, 3 informational handouts or flyers, again, on the employee notice requirements, earning statement, and record keeping, and an example employee notice in English, and then translated into 13 languages that includes the required text asking employees if they would like to receive the notice in a language other than English. Now, the department was not obligated to create this form, but we did so because, one, we wanted to ease the translation process. So if we did a form that met the requirements of the law and then we translated into 13 languages immediately, and the way we crafted that form, we were very deliberate about it so that the information that would actually be filled in would require as little or no translation as possible. So if the employee asked for the form in another language, you know, exactly the same information could be put into that form that would be put in the English form, and there would be little or no need to, you know, subsequently translate the information that was inserted. So in some ways we received some criticism about the form, but part of the reason we did it that way was in order so that, you know, if an employee requests that the information be provided in another language, then obviously, so then the employer would be able to utilize this form, but then if they filled in the information, you know, they would then have to go hire a translator to then translate that additional information. So we tried to craft the form in a way that would reduce that need, either eliminate it or reduce it as much as possible, to ease that requirement, that language requirement for employers. So now the time to develop these materials was extremely limited to the law's July 1st effective date. So we basically had 30 days before the law went into effect. And as a result, during the development of these materials, the department was also gathering and receiving feedback and working to update them in real time, particularly as questions became, you know, initial questions, and then the questions would become more nuanced, you know, requiring then more nuanced answers. And so the department has been working very hard to try to make sure that we are, one, responding to all the questions we received, but as, you know, employers were working through the requirements and came back sometimes with additional questions, we tried to update in real time the answers so that, you know, it would provide that additional nuance and potentially be valuable to other employers who were working to comply with the law. So in some places where that happened, is in the issue of bonuses. So, you know, when the first questions came in, they were questions about bonuses that would be considered wages. And so therefore the response of the department was that yes, you know, if part of the way you're paying people is to provide bonuses, well then that would need to be provided in the notice. But then employers came back and said, well, what about discretionary bonuses? What about that, you know, merit award or whatever it might be? Well, under law, those are not considered wages, and therefore there would be no obligation to include that in the notice requirement. So the department updated its Q&A to say, well, you know, if there's two different kinds of bonuses, one is considered wages, one's not, one would be required in the notice, one would not. So those are the kinds of situations where the department worked to evolve in real time, you know, the answers to the questions it was providing. You know, we had questions also about deductions, and whether there was an obligation to articulate what was in the notice, what was the specific deduction, amount of the deduction. And basically, through conversations with employers, you know, it was clear that often the employer does not know what the exact amount of the deduction will be on any given pay cycle, and therefore the department's guidance reflected that then they just needed to list the type of deduction, and only on the earnings statement would they have to indicate the actual amount of deduction that was taken in that payroll cycle. So as a consequence, the department has been working hard to assist employers. Now, in an ideal world, we might have had a few more months and we could have met with employers to be able to ask them about what would be the issues, and we could have potentially crafted, you know, in response, based on that kind of an exchange, you know, guidance that, you know, would have hit on more issues that employers would raise from the very beginning. But I think the department has done its best. One, the official guidance that we provided has not changed. The only thing that's changed and become more nuanced are the Q&A, the responses to questions. That is not official guidance of the department. That's our attempt to simply assist employers in navigating the new law. So the actual formal document that says guidance to employers, that has not changed. That has remained constant. But our ability to try to assist employers in navigating their various situations, that has been done in the in the context of the Q&A questions, and of course, as new questions come in, that Q&A evolves. The department has also worked to find solutions to particular issues that employers have raised. So, for example, we have had questions about, well, can we simply reference a collective bargaining agreement or an employer handbook, employee handbook, or a formal policy? And the department has responded that, yes, you can. You can reference those documents in the notice as long as that reference document, if I read it and I look at, you know, that salary chart, I can look at that chart and say, oh, this is what I'm going to be paid. So the employee has enough information about their specific situation to be able to use that document to know what they're going to be paid. So let me give you another example. So you have a policy regarding PTO. So the policy says that after 30 days from your date of you start work, you will receive 10 days of PTO for the next year. And then the document says, and then thereafter, on your anniversary date, you will receive an additional 10 days of PTO. And then furthermore, that document says, this is how you can use that PTO. So basically, our position would be, you could, in the notice, you could simply reference that document, because that employee knows, when they read that document, how much PTO they're going to get, when they're going to get it, and to what degree that PTO will play out into the future. So not only will that be sufficient to reference that document in the notice document, but there's no obligation to provide that employee with any change notice, because unless the employer changes the policy and increases it to 15 days of PTO or changes the circumstances under which an employee can use it, there's no need to provide that employee with any additional notice, like the change notice. So there's no obligation on their anniversary date, when they get another 10 hours, to then issue them a notice that they got another 10 hours, because they already know from the initial notice that they're going to get another 10 hours when they reach their anniversary date. So what we have found is that, particularly with the change notice, that employers are actually doing, and a lot of their issues that they've raised about the time it's taking or the burden that it's taking, is actually because employers are doing more than the law requires. So we, now that we are not only answering questions about how to implement the law, but we are learning now about what employers have done to implement the law, we have the ability to further then update our guidance to sort of say, here's what you need to do, but here's what you don't need to do, to help then employers better understand what the law actually requires. So consequently, like I said, a lot of the feedback that we received during the Senate hearing, the feedback during the Grocers Association meeting that I have had a week or so ago, actually the gentleman in, I think, not sure which grocery, and probably shouldn't say anyway, chain, but basically got up and said, thank you for this conversation, because I think I can safely say that everyone in this room has done more than the law requires them to do. So now I see, as my agency's mandate, is that we need to help those employers understand what the law actually requires, and more importantly, what the law doesn't require. And so we will be working on how to sort of probably create some sort of juxtaposition between, this is what you need to do, but this is not what you need to do. So we kind of bookend, ideally bookend employers' understanding. So it continues to be the department's priority to ensure that employers and workers understand what the law requires. Department has taken no enforcement action against any employer based on their compliance with the notice requirements in the law. But the priority of the department the priority of the department is to assist workers when they've not been paid the wages that they are owed. And that will continue to be the priority of the department going forward, as we continue to assist employers with understanding what the law requires. So with that, I thank you, Chair, for the opportunity to present and update you on the department's activities.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. We have four other testifiers, and you have a hard stop at 9:20. I'm gonna take a little pause here then. I know there are some serious questions people want to ask you.
Okay.
So I will open it up for 30 minutes, and then we'll bring down the testifiers unless we run out of questions for you in 30 minutes. So would that be Representative Baker?
Am I up first, Mr. Chair?
Go right ahead.
Oh, thank you. And I was kind of thinking we would hear the testifiers first, but I do maybe just
I do, but and I think you understand that she has a hard stop at 9:20.
Thank you for that. So I'll be fairly brief because it's important that we hear from the testifiers
right.
as well. Thank you. Just what I'm hearing from the commissioner. Thank you for being a partner with our employers. We always knew here in Minnesota we have 99% employers really understand it, get it. They want to work with you. They don't want to make a mistake. And we were singing that tune here for a long time last year when we were working on this bill. You're seeing it now firsthand because they're overdoing it. We tend to do that in Minnesota. We overdo it. But it's caused a lot of confusion because we don't want to get in trouble. We don't want to find ourselves in the paper. We don't want to find ourselves with a fine. And so all what we were doing last year was trying to find this right balance without making it harder to do business in Minnesota. And I think you have a huge part of making sure that you're bringing a lot of calmness to us. And so thank you for reaching out to so many groups. But I think you made a couple comments about the bonuses, for example. Whether it's an annual bonus, whether it's just a at-will bonus, it's a wage. It is a wage. They pay tax on that wage. And so my point is we see it one way. And so as an employer who pays tipped employees and who does other things, those are wages to us. So we can't separate that. And so I want to make sure that that's a good reason why we are asking those kind of questions. I appreciate your understanding of this reference to the handbooks. And here's my question. I'm an employer that has a handbook. And you made the comment that if you have maybe a collective bargaining and if you have a handbook that shows my rates of pay for housekeepers or for certain things and ranges, are you saying now that I don't have to do the single pages for new employees and for ongoing rate changes if I have that in a handbook or a collective bargaining? I want to be clear to that because that's the first time I've heard this.
So basically, you need to provide a notice to the employee that, but what I'm saying is that you can reference that or link to it if it's electronic, that policy to meet the requirement of, for example, if it's rate or rates of pay. So, for example, if you have you've hired a clerk, I realize that, but and that clerk could work a day shift, a night shift, a weekend shift, and you have different rates of pay for that, and that's set out in a handbook or your pay policy, then in the notice you can simply reference that policy.
And Mr. Chair,
and then going forward. You don't have to issue another notice to that employee that, well, tonight because you're working a night shift, you're going to be paid another $2 an hour, or next weekend because you're going to work a weekend, you're going to make, you're going to get additional dollar an hour. Because all of that information would have been provided to the worker in that initial notice.
Representative Baker.
And thank you. And is that in the bill? Does it say that in the bill that those types of employment documents are acceptable for those notices?
So basically what, I mean, the bill is quite simple. It simply says that you need to provide written notice to your employees of the following information. So therefore, consequently, but the law does not prescribe how that notice, what kind of form or how that notice would be provided. So in an app, and part of, you always have a challenge when you write laws as to if you become more and more prescriptive, then of course, everyone does things differently, and therefore, you're then forcing people who might otherwise meet the intention of the law to do something that they wouldn't otherwise be required to do. So the simplicity of the law was intended to allow employers to ideally integrate, you know, review their practices and procedures, and if they were already meeting the law's requirements, you know, they don't need to do something else. But if they weren't, then, you know, we tried to create that, provide tools to them that would help them.
Thank you. And my final comment, Mr. Chair.
No more questions.
No more questions, but I think it brings up a point, is that that the simplicity then maybe of it is what's causing a lot of this confusion, because we had 100 people in a room in the Wilmer Lakes Area Chamber, had a HR meeting, and there was just so many questions. Maybe it was because it was too simple. They had all these documents, but they didn't know that was part of it, because maybe they weren't used as an example in the bill, i.e. Collective bargaining, or i.e. a handbook. I think that would have helped, but we're here to try to help this, help your position going forward, and help the bill get better as it goes along. I don't want to take any more time, but that's, I think, what's causing us to have some confusion, is because there wasn't some of that clarity for us.
Chairman Mahoney, could I just...
Please.
Representative Baker, the intention of the department, because this, I think, would resolve a lot of the issues that employers have raised, is the department's going to create a notice document that actually makes, you know, is an example of how to reference those documents, and so that they can more readily see, and the department has put out an example about how to do that. We will work to push that out, and now that we have some of these real nutty, you know, what seems to be the core basis of misunderstanding, you know, the department will now redouble its efforts to push out again some specific assistance related to these core questions that employers have.
And if I may add in, we tried to keep it, we tried to lay out examples in the negotiations, which were contentious enough. And I'm very impressed with the department with its laying out examples, because what we lay out this year will set the example going forward, because I will not always be chairman. Tim Walz will not always be governor. Commissioner Lepik will not always be commissioner. But if we lay down a hard example, it'll be harder for someone to come along and throw it all up in the air to make big changes, because there's enough people in this room here, if not in this building, that would raise holy hell if all of a sudden we, after all of this, they decided to try to do something significantly different. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here. And I appreciate all your work at communicating with businesses. I know I hear from a lot of businesses in my district who are very concerned about, they feel they're doing the right thing, but they're really nervous about making sure so that they don't get these onerous fines. So to that, the question that you just finished with Representative Baker about how you'll come up with this new form, or you've said a couple times you've issued additional guidance, but the official guidance hasn't changed. So you said you have done these nuanced Q&As, but if they're not the official guidance, can those really be relied upon? Because for these small businesses, they're so concerned about what they can rely on. Thank you. And then I have a follow-up.
Chair Mahoney, Representative Robbins. Well, this is where we get a little bit in between a rock and a hard place as an executive branch agency, because we're not allowed to issue interpretations without going through rulemaking. And so consequently, when you look at our guidance document, it's fairly straightforward articulation of what the law requires. When we do Q&A, you know, we're trying to provide assistance, ideally trying to provide assistance for employers to navigate. So this is where it gets tricky. We haven't had time, but it is possible that the department could look at doing rules that could then articulate some of these more specifically, that we would move from guidance to sort of law, and then if you do what the law says, then you can have confidence that you're doing the right thing. But we're trying to do our best to provide employers with the assistance. I mean, the department is primarily responsible for enforcing the law, but there are other entities that also enforce the law. So that's another thing we are trying to navigate as the department, because we're trying to, you know, what I might accept as a commissioner in, 2020, might not be, what another commissioner would accept. And so therefore, we're also trying to, in some of the proposals the department had, was sort of some discussions of things like best practices, or that we were trying to sort of make sure, we're trying to be confident that the assistance that we were providing would, if employers follow that guidance, that they could be confident that they were complying with the law. So So I think what we can do is give some more examples. I would imagine that if a court were to look at this, they would give some deference to the guidance and the interpretation that the department has given, but they're not obligated to.
No, go ahead.
Thank you.
Not obligated. Okay.
Mr. Chair, one more.
One more.
Thank you. So thank you for that. I know it's an odd sort of limbo place to be, but I appreciate you stating that. Secondly, on enforcement, you stated that your intention is to go after the bad actors, which we all agree. I feel like most employers are doing a fantastic job, but if there are bad actors out there, we certainly want everyone to be paid what they are owed. But I just wonder if you could comment on enforcement a little bit. Are you going to go after people where you've had an allegation of wage theft, or are you going to be doing random audits? Like, what is the priority in terms of enforcement?
Commissioner?
Chair Mahoney, Representative Robbins. So the department has sort of two ways that it works to achieve compliance with the law. So first of all, I think my responsibility is not just to go around and conduct inspections. My priority should be using all of the tools in my toolbox to bring to ensure there's compliance with the law. For many employers, that is simply providing them with good information. And when they call us to assist them with what they need to do to comply with the law, and that's the compliance strategy. For some employers, it does require an inspection. Sometimes with one inspection, that's all that's needed to bring that employer into compliance. But basically, the department primarily responds to requests for assistance. And that assistance isn't always from employees. We get calls actually from other employers who are concerned about the practices of other businesses, often with which they are in competition. But then we also have the authority to basically inspect workplaces for which we have not received a complaint. And what my approach to that is that if I inspect a workplace that's in compliance, I've wasted that workplace's time. I've also wasted my investigator's time. So what the department will be doing is working on, based on its own data, within the agency, whether it's our own complaint data, whether it's data related to employers who we know are not carrying workers' compensation, where we have other compliance issues, and we will be looking at trying to identify whether there are particular sectors, particular regions where we are concerned that there is not compliance with the labor standards laws in the states, and we will be focusing our investigation resources on those sectors in order to work to bring that sector into compliance with the law. So therefore, that's how we will allocate our resources.
Seems that there is no other questions, I'm going to move to ask you to sit down and bring Mr. Thaden come down and testify to his interaction with the law. Welcome to the committee. Welcome to the committee, and identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gary Thaden. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Minnesota Mechanical Contractors Association and the Minnesota Contractors of the National Electrical Contractors Association. I represent about 300 employers who do everything from single-family homes to schools, solar projects, and repiping the refineries. It would have been nice, thank you, Representative Mahoney, I know you've done work out there. It would have been nice, I will say, to have more than a month and a day to comply with this law, but the last 10 days of June, I spent most of my time helping employers. A half a dozen construction trade associations got together and worked on a form. We worked off of the department's draft form that they put out, and we put our own out on July 2nd. We sent it to 500 or 600 employers across the state of Minnesota. These employers all have collective bargaining agreements with local unions. It was very helpful to have that the department put out that form for us. We then contacted the department, and the assistant commissioner did a seminar for us. We were able to record that on video and put it up on the web so that the rest of the employers could look at that video. She spent over an hour talking to us. There were over 100 employers who were in the room asking her questions. The department has been extremely helpful. It is great that we can use electronic means to send out these notices. I have told employers that they should send a copy of their collective bargaining agreement in addition to the notice to every employee. Every collective bargaining agreement that that employee might work under should be included. And to be able to do that electronically rather than in hard copy, it was extremely helpful. I have one employer that thought on June 20th this would take, they would have to hire somebody half-time in order to comply with the law. Since then, they have not hired that person and have integrated it into their HR department and are complying with the law. I will stand for any questions.
Well, because we're going to be done at 9:30, I'd ask that you step to the side and we'll
sure.
call down Octavio Chung. Hopefully I got that right.
Good morning, everyone, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to let me comment on today's hearing on waste theft. My name is Octavio Chung. I'm an organizer for the Labor's Union, La Yuna. Although I'm a proud union member, this is not about union or non-union workers. This law is about workers' dignity. Part of my job is visiting job sites to educate workers about their rights. And I want to share a story that we go across all the time. About 2 months ago, I got a call from Raul Castillo Hernandez, who was working for Black Rock Masonry, a subcontractor from Wisconsin working on the Apple Valley Menards reconstruction project. He was hired on January 9th of this year, and he was promised $25 with the hotel room cover and no benefits. The hiring foreman offered a 2-month job and said they did not want to deal with paperwork. Raul was also told that if he missed work due to illness or any other event, that they will charge him for the hotel. Raul and his fellow workers were setting blocks in January and in cold weather. And you have to heat your work area when you do this type of work. When you are laying blocks, you have to heat your work area. The workers asked their foreman if they were going to hit the area, and they were told not to worry about it, just to keep working. Hitting the area when you are laying black is important for two reasons. One is to make sure that your mud is going to cure properly, and two is because it's difficult to lay blacks in the winter. It's difficult. Many of the workers complain to each other, to their foreman, but they were afraid. They were afraid to say something. Yeah, they were complaining to each other, but they did not complain to their foreman because they were afraid. So they decided to quit, and they never got paid. Raul and his co-workers confirmed with their foreman that they will receive their final payment, and they made arrangement for a direct deposit. A full week went by when Raul finally reached out to the foreman about not receiving his final paycheck, his final check, to which the foreman told him that he did not have time to check for anybody's bills. To date, Raul has hasn't got paid yet. Raul was also not an independent contractor that could negotiate his term of employment. This is a case of waste theft, and we have Raul's personal testimony and copy of the emails. So we help him and his co-worker to submit a demand letter to the company asking for their money. And the company replied, and I quote, since you were never entered into our payroll system, we have to treat you as an independent contractor. They also send W-9 forms via email to the worker. They also told him that they were looking into whether or not he checked out of the hotel room, and if he had not, they will charge him for the room. They were just intimidation. La Yuna also helped Raul submit a formal complaint to the Department of Labor Industries, and the case is pending. This story is one amongst the hundreds of thousands that demonstrate why the employee notice and record keeping requirement of the waste theft law are so important. Workers need the employee notice so they know that they are supposed to get paid. Employers who don't keep accurate records must be held accountable. When people work, they should be paid. Just as customers pay for their items in these stores before they are able to take these items home, workers should also get paid on time. It's just fair. It just makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, if you could stick around, if there's some time left, there may be some questions. Representative Baker, did you have someone? Tammy Hedlstead?
Mr. Chair, yes. Tammy Hedlstead from West Central Industries is here to share her story. Thank you.
Morning.
Good morning. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Sure. I'm Tammy Hedlstead. I'm a little rusty on public speaking, so I have my notes down here. My name is Tammy Hedlstead, and I've worked for a nonprofit organization called West Central Industries for 27 years. We serve over 425 individuals annually and provide work experiences for approximately 110 persons with disabilities each month in the Wilmer and Hutchinson areas. Our organization supports persons with disabilities to reach their employment or other day service goals. I'm representing WCI today to request an exemption to the Minnesota Wage Theft Law for licensed providers of day and employment services, as well as extended employment providers. Our programs provide a variety of training and work opportunities to persons with disabilities. The programs are regulated by the Department of Labor with specific guidelines around wage payment practices, including notification of wages. The new requirements of the Minnesota Wage Theft Law add an additional layer of reporting and notification requirements that are difficult for providers to manage. We want to give every potential work opportunity we can to our clients, which also means training schedules that can vary weekly, offering new piece-rated jobs that may have a 24-hour turnaround time or a stringent deadline, biannual productivity evaluations for hourly jobs, annual prevailing rate changes, and in addition, quarterly average rate changes. It's not that we don't want to inform the persons we serve with information related to their employment, but the amount of new documentation needed has resulted in each person receiving multiple notifications. And these multiple notifications have caused persons we serve confusion, along with presenting a huge administrative burden. Finding work that fits the persons we serve is both challenging and competitive. We compete to get work in the community or do work in our facility with outside companies through placing bids or developing contracts. When bids are accepted or contracts are signed, we face quick turnaround times to meet our customers' needs. This work gives the people we serve employment experience along with great pride in earning an income. However, making sure the wage notification is completed, distributed, and explained prior to the job completion sometimes means that not all of our clients are able to participate in this work opportunity. WCI and other providers understand the importance of why this law was created and expect to conform to the wage theft law for our staff members. However, we are requesting an exemption for the program participant to receive a paycheck from our organization. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And if you'll stick around if there's some questions. Timothy Kasky. Good morning. Please identify yourself and proceed for the tape, and please proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to talk to you about the wage theft law. My name is Tim Kasky. I am the Executive Director of Human Resources with ISD 728, which represents the communities of Elk River, Otsego, Rogers, and Zimmerman. I'm also a member of the Minnesota Association of School Personnel Administrators, MASPA. ISD 728 is the eighth largest district in the state with a student enrollment of 13,500 and slightly over 2,100 employees. As a district, we support the intent of the law, and we are doing our best to comply with the mandates. Although we believe it's important to be transparent with employees so that they understand how their pay and benefits work, school districts have already developed pathways to do this. That is why I'm here to ask you to consider two changes to the law. First, substitute a collective bargaining agreement for both the initial and the change notices. In ISD 728, like many other districts, we focus our resources on the classroom and student achievement. For us, this is evidence in our ESSA accountability test scores, which includes the MCA. Of the 10 largest districts in the state, our district was number one in reading and number one in math. Prioritizing student learning leaves limited resources for operational and support functions like the Human Resources Department and others. Our HR department is 8 people, and that includes me. We support over 2,100 employees. To make the most of our resources, we work hard to reduce inefficiencies and redundant work. We estimate that under the current law and the current guidance, between the initial change and the change notices, we average about 4,000 notices a year. For example, a teacher who, as a result of continuing education, could receive up to 2 notices a year for education advances in their salary, as well as another notice for their yearly contract increase. More importantly, that these notices create a redundancy of information that is already contained in the collective bargaining agreement. Our agreements are readily available to all our employees and the public on our district website. Approximately 80% of our employees are covered by a collective bargaining agreement. By removing the notices for collective bargaining agreements, that would reduce our workload by about 80% in delivering these notices, and it would meet our employee needs. My second request is to provide a 30-day grace period in providing the initial or the change notice. Our district, like many others, faces limited time requirements in putting staff in place. For example, we operate 6 locations where we have early childhood education and child care. Under the DHS rules, we are required to maintain a ratio of child care workers to students. We also employ supervisors in each one of those locations. In the event our supervisor is absent or the position becomes vacant, we routinely upgrade one of our child care workers to cover the supervision. Many times this occurs on the day in which the vacancy occurs. The change creates an increase in the employee's hourly rate. Under the current law, we'd be unable to react in a timely manner to immediately meet this need, since the notice must be given before the change occurs. By providing a grace period, we can make the change and follow up with the new wage information. Another situation occurs when we have a head or a lead custodian absent from one of our buildings. In this case, we would upgrade a qualified custodian who holds an appropriate boiler license to fill in for that person being absent. There are times due to illness or unexpected emergency that we have less than an hour lead time to make this work. Under our contract, the upgrade custodian is entitled to additional pay for taking on those additional responsibilities. Under the current law, we need to provide a notice of that change in advance of that change. This could mean not having a qualified employee on site for the safety of the building and the students or the staff, and not having someone to assume the role that has the appropriate licensure. These are just 2 examples. But these are situations that happen all the time in school districts, particularly in extracurricular activities, such as sporting events, where districts rely on the community to handle such jobs as concessions, ticket taking, et cetera, on an ad hoc basis. On behalf of our superintendent, Dr. Dan Bittman, and the ISD school board, I want to thank you for this opportunity and respectfully ask that you consider these changes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cassidy. I think we have one question, and then I believe Representative Haley wanted to read something, or does that need to be, because it's in our packet.
If time allows, I would like to. My testifier could not make it this morning.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe if the department could come down. Our timing is exactly off with the commissioner having to leave at this point. But Mr. Caskey, I'm confused, and I'm hoping between you and the department I can become less so. In my personal conversation with the commissioner, as well as what I understood her testimony to be today, the provision of a copy of the collective bargaining agreement to a teacher meets the notice requirements. And I recall as when I was teaching, each year I got a contract sheet that said, this is where you are on the salary schedule. This is what your salary is for this year. Have a good year.
Mr. Cassidy.
I also then received a copy of the contract every 2 years after the contract was settled. So the commissioner has identified that she's met with MSBA. You're not MSBA, I understand, but the message I'm hearing consistently from the department is the provision of a contract meets the notice requirements. So why would we need to waive or amend this law if that meets the statute?
Mr. Cassidy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Devani. Yes, the contract contains all that information in it. But the current guidance would say that when there is a change, we have to notify the employee. With respect to the commissioner, she has also met with the association group that I am a part of, and we thank her for that. She, her and her staff listened to our concerns a number of times. The suggested change that the department is suggesting to make is not current guidance. And so I would qualify that my testimony I gave is based on the Q&A that is currently sitting out on the department's website in terms of changes in initial notice. In addition, the request that we are asking for is not to provide the initial notice, is to substitute the initial notice for the collective bargaining agreement. My staff, although it's a one-page form, for us it is a manual process to go through and individually fill those out for every individual. We're probably, although it may only take 3-4 minutes to do that, when you add that up 4,000 times, that's a lot of time. And when we're trying to support 2,100 employees to do that, that takes my staff away from other important needs that our employees. And at times, I'm the executive director, I fill it and I do those forms and meet with the employee. So that's our request. I don't disagree that there's so much information in the collective bargaining agreement. And yes, we do provide it to the employee when we bring them on board, and we do provide it to them whenever we make a change.
Ms. Bisenbach?
That's correct. Chair Mahoney, Representative Dabney, I can give a little bit more nuance to that conversation. So the department's guidance has been that a collective bargaining agreement could meet some of the requirements in the law. It really depends on how, if the employee who is provided that initial collective bargaining agreement can look at that collective bargaining agreement and determine what their rate of pay is, what their accrual of their vacation or PTO or sick leave is, and how they can use it. But the problem can sometimes be that collective bargaining agreements aren't always personalized. So in a teacher collective bargaining agreement, you're gonna have a salary schedule that has steps and lanes. And in order for me as a new teacher coming into a district to understand where on that salary schedule I fall, I need to know what my step is, and I need to know what my lane is. So as long as that information is provided as part of that initial upon hire notice, giving the collective bargaining agreement at that time will satisfy some of that obligation. There's also the obligation to sign the initial notice, as well as some other information that may or may not be included in a collective bargaining agreement. So it really is looking at the specific requirements that are in the law and determining if that notice that's provided with the signature and any documents that it's referring to, like the collective bargaining agreement or handbook, meet all of those specific requirements, and then having that signed. So it can, but it is not always going to. But after that initial notice is provided upon hire or at the start of employment, a collective bargaining agreement or a handbook is really going to help relieve some of the obligation for the change notifications. So if I know by looking at this collective bargaining agreement that every year I'm going to go up one step, there's no requirement to give a change notice each year because I already was informed in that initial notice upon hire with the referral to the collective bargaining agreement that my step is going to increase each year by one. Or if the collective bargaining agreement tells me that if I get my paperwork in showing that I received my master's degree by a certain time and that is approved, there's no need to provide that change notification because I've already been told in that initial notice with the provision of the collective bargaining agreement that my pay is going to increase. I'm going to go to master's level on the lane at the time I'm approved for that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So the second situation that Mr. Kasky referred to with a custodian being temporarily promoted to head custodian, would the notice requirement be met if they had a copy of the collective bargaining agreement that said, as custodian you make X as an hourly wage, and as head custodian you make Y as hourly wage?
Chair Mahoney, Representative Dabney, that is correct. So if at the start of employment I receive my initial notice and it gives me a bunch of rates of pay or refers to a collective bargaining agreement that have a number of rates of pay that apply in different circumstances, like a custodian who goes up to a boilermaker, or this could be in like the same with the teacher who goes up in lanes. That initial notice with that information is going to be enough to satisfy the obligation of any change notification because you've already been told if you work the weekend and you get this shift differential, or if you go to a different class of employment, that new rate will apply. And there's no obligation then to follow up with a change notification because you've already been told at the start of employment that that other rate of pay would apply.
Okay. We have
understood, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the time.
Thank you. Representative Robbins, briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, both of you, for testifying. So just to be clear, referencing the earlier testimony, Mr. Thaden, he implied that just sending the electronic collective bargaining agreement was sufficient, but you seem to be saying, as it says on the FAQ on your website, I just looked it up, that it has to be signed. So just emailing the collective bargaining agreement is not sufficient.
Ms. Beth Beckenbach.
It's, thanks, Chair Mahoney, Representative Robbins. It is, I believe what Mr. Thaden testified to earlier is that they develop their own form, that is their notice form. They fill out that form and they refer to the collective bargaining agreement. They then electronically send the form and the collective bargaining agreement to the employee. The employee then can sign it electronically and return it. There is an obligation in the law to have the employee sign the notice and acknowledge receipt of that initial notice. The department has issued a Q&A that says that an electronic signature is recognized under state law and can be used. So electronic receipt of the notice and electronic return with an electronic signature will satisfy that obligation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Very quickly. So regarding Mr. Kosky's testimony about the change notice in advance of these temporary changes, your testimony is that that is not necessary for school districts if it's in the collective bargaining agreement. Just, I want to be very clear on this.
Chair Mahoney, Representative Robbins, that is correct if that rate has already been provided. So if it's in the collective bargaining agreement or if it was in the initial notice, if the initial notice refers to a number of rates of pay that might apply, if they have already met the obligation to inform that employee of what rate of pay will apply, then a change notification or a change notice would not be necessary.
Thank you. I think further clarification on that would be fair.
Oh, sorry.
You can
I'm sorry, Mr.
catch
Chair.
Up with her when we're done. Representative Stevenson.
Commissioner Bischenbach, can I ask, we had a conversation about the second concern that the witness articulated about notice before any employment starts. I wonder if you have any thoughts about that you can share with the committee, about whether it's necessary to have all the notice done before, you know, the first minute of work.
And I guess that I want to be clear here, because I've heard this from multiple people. You know, how do I get some fellow to come down from to be the referee or the popcorn salesperson at the sporting event? And they're very worried that they have to shut down their refreshments. So how does that work? What do they do?
Chair Mahoney and Representative Stevenson, so there are two pieces to the law. There is the initial notice that is at the start of employment. That is not all the law says about that is that must be given at the start of employment. Then there's a change notice that the law specifically says needs to be provided before the change occurs. So in a situation where you already have an employee that you've already given a notice to and there is a change that you have not provided notice about, so no collective bargaining agreement that outlines the change, no rate of pay that had already been provided, then the law does require that change to be provided before, that notice to be provided before the change. But like I've already testified, if the change was already outlined in the initial notice, then you've already met that obligation. But as far as the initial notice, what the law says is at the start of employment. And what the department's guidance has been on that is incorporate your initial notice as part of your new employee paperwork, because that is the start of employment.
So, Mr. Chair, if we just clarify, in terms of that initial notice then, it's the agency's position that as long as you're doing it during your normal onboarding process, it's not necessary to do it, you know, at the first before any work can be done, the first minute of employment, right? Am I understanding correctly?
Chair Mahoney, Representative Stevenson, that's correct. I mean, the main thing is that the notice is required to give certain things like the date of the first paycheck, which is, we think, an incredibly important part of the notice because it tells somebody this is what you're going to be paid and this is when you're going to be paid, and then the reoccurrence of pay after that. So, yes, at the start of employment, but you got to make sure to include all of the required pieces that are outlined in the law.
Thank you.
It would seem to me that for school district, I only have a couple more months to listen to the complaints. But for those coming after me, it would be nice if the department would come up with a program to how you would fill in at the football game or the hockey game or whatever. Because I don't think that's that big of an issue here. I just think it's an annoyance and a worry. And it's not something that somebody's going to go to jail or get fined for. So having said that, I thank you, Mr. Cassie. Representative Haley, did you want to read into the record your and I think this in 20 years will be the first time I've seen it heard it read into the record. But go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My testifier, Laurel Aiken, the HR benefits director from Red Wing Shoe, couldn't make it this morning, but I think it is very important for this committee to hear from a large employer because we haven't had that feedback this morning in the testimony. And I first want to comment and thank Commissioner Lepping. She has been to my district, not on this issue, but she has met with employers. And Chair Mahoney, I appreciate your intent of this law. We don't want people to be treated unfairly. So we are just trying to give feedback on potential modifications. So again, Red Wing Shoe, one of the largest employers in my district, and they've been around since 1905. This is from their HR director. I have estimated labor costs since the inception of the wage theft legislation. The implementation labor costs were approximately $15,000, and our ongoing costs will be approximately $10,000 per year. To a company of our size, that may not seem like a lot of cost to you. But what is infuriating is that the items that were required to outline on the wage theft form are items that were already available to our employees. Therefore, we consider this a non-value-added mandate. We pay our HRIS partner at least $50,000 a year to have individual employee information available online. Employees can log into Ultimate Software to see their rate of pay, their vacation balance, and whether they are exempt or non-exempt, et cetera. Each year, they can log in to see their bonus amount and their individual pay increase. In addition, our HR staff is always available to answer questions they may have about pay and benefits. We have sound processes and practices, communications, and support. The timeline of the implementation of the wage theft law was highly unacceptable to us and caused us to shift priorities and to stop projects already in their tracks. A project that has yet to get back off the ground because we had to get back into our internal queue for capital funding. So a project that we were going to do that would have eliminated manual work had to stop so we could shift to this manual work mandated by the state, doubling down where we would have been. The wage theft legislation is clearly meant to target industries and individual violators. We would request that it focus on those and not the rest of the employers who already work tirelessly to create remarkable employee experiences. And in closing, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to comment. When we implement new laws and programs, we see in bills up to 10% for administrative costs. And government adds administrative costs when we expect an agency to implement new things. Employers don't do that. And employers are the lifeblood of the state. So I appreciate you giving me the time to read this testimony. We have, as you have said before, 99% of our employers do the right thing. And I just think we need to be kind of watchdogs here that we're not continually adding costs, which affects wage growth and job growth, which is our priority in this committee. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no other business before the committee today, we stand adjourned.